You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello from Studio One here in London and welcome to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme.
With an overwhelming majority, after 2 years of drafting, the Tunisian Constituent Assembly passed one of the most, if not the most, progressive constitution in the Arab world.
From Tunis and Kiev to Sana'a and Geneva, we'll review the day's top stories with John Everard and George Brock right here in the studio. And later in the programme.
America the brave still fears what we don't know. God loves all his children, is somehow forgotten, but we paraphrase a book written 3,500 years ago. I don't know.
We'll look back on the winners and losers at the Grammys. All that, plus a check-in with our man in Buenos Aires, a review of the latest London art exhibitions, and maybe a song or two for you as well. All that coming up right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty ahead in the next hour here on Midori House. Before we get started, let's hear from Paul Osborne, who's here with the latest world news.
The head of Egypt's army is set to confirm he will run for president. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi led the move to depose the last president, Mohamed Morsi. Today, Egypt's top military body approved his candidature and promoted him from general to the rank of field marshal. He's expected to resign his military role within days. Samer Saif al-Yassal, who's a security analyst in Cairo, thinks there's little doubt he'll win.
I'm sure he will talk to the people about the problems and the issues we are facing now in this country. He has to tell the people, I think he will, that we have issues. These issues will take some time. You have to bear with me. We are going to suffer a little bit. And we have to know that beforehand. Then people will accept the plans.
Talks on the crisis in Syria are deadlocked. Representatives of Bashar al-Assad's regime presented a declaration of principles earlier that made no mention of a transfer of power, a key demand of the opposition. The talks have been temporarily halted, but the UN mediator to the crisis in Syria, Lakhdar Brahimi, has said he won't give up.
You know, I'm glad that there is apparently the will to continue these discussions. You know, once again, I tell you, you know, we never expected any miracle. There are no miracles here. We will continue and see if progress can be made and when.
It's thought up to 74 people have been killed in attacks on two villages in the northwest of Nigeria. 52 are believed to have died when militants attacked a village in Borno State, while further south in Adamawa State, 22 people died in an attack on a church service. Both have been blamed on the Islamist group Boko Haram. The states where both attacks happened are under emergency powers as the military tries to defeat the insurgents. Anti-government protesters have ended their occupation of the Justice Ministry in Kiev, which they stormed on Sunday night. They withdrew after the minister threatened to call for a state of emergency and an end to negotiations with opposition groups. Four people have died in the past week as the protests against Viktor Yanukovych's government intensify. But Ukraine's foreign minister, Leonid Kuchera, says they're still trying to find a solution.
We are not considering the introduction of the state of emergency. According to the constitution and law in Ukraine, the introduction of the state of emergency is a very complicated procedure. Today, this matter is not on the table.
Two men have been arrested in the United States, accused of $1 million money laundering operation. Both ran exchanges trading the virtual currency Bitcoin. They're accused of conspiring to sell Bitcoins to users of an online drugs marketplace. The US military has launched a missile strike against a suspected militant leader in Somalia. It's thought an Al-Shabaab commander was the target of the strike in a remote district in the south of the country. A number of other people are thought to have been killed in the strike. China says its Jade Rabbit moon rover is in trouble. State media say it suffered a mechanical control abnormality. It's apparently unable to easily traverse the lunar surface. The rover landed on the moon last month and was expected to spend 3 months exploring. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours. We'll have more news from Paul at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To va Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news are John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, and George Brock, head of journalism at City University London and author of Out of Print, Newspapers, Journalism and the Business of News in the Digital Age. Gentlemen, welcome both to the programme.
Hi.
Let's start today in Geneva, where diplomats and government officials from countries the world over have gathered behind closed doors for some of the time to try and solve the seemingly unsolvable crisis that is the Syrian civil war. I want to talk a little bit about how you basically do peace talks. John, if I can start with you, do you think what we're seeing here is actually a sensible way of carrying out this kind of endeavour?
Well, yes. I mean, it's the tried and trusted formula, bringing people together into one big room so everybody gets to hear what everybody else says and can respond to it and put forward views and put forward counter views. It's inevitable, this being 2014, that there's a media circus. This isn't always particularly helpful, particularly as we've seen on several occasions where people try to apply pressure to what goes on inside the room by talking to people outside it, trying to bring media attention in. But the basic format, if anything's going to work, this is likely to be it. Whether it will work or not, of course, we still don't know.
I just want to ask you, in terms of your own experience, I mean, how do you sort of deal with, how do you fend off the unwanted advances of journalists who are trying to maybe shape the narrative, you know, inform where the dialogue's going? Do you have to be evasive? Can you be clear about the fact that you're there and you've got a broader objective? I mean, how do you sort of fend off those?
There's no one-size-fits-all solution. It depends entirely on the journalist. Some journalists are actually sensitive and intelligent people. I know this comes to surprise.
I cannot believe that for one moment.
Well, there you go. And you simply explain, you know, there are things you can say, things you can't say, you know, and bits on the record, bits aren't, and they'll work with that. Others, you quickly learn, you just don't deal with. This is too dangerous, and they're likely to shape whatever you say to form towards their own ends, which isn't helpful to what you're trying to achieve inside the room.
George, if you've got a thousand accredited journalists, or however many it is, does that create an out-of-control press corps, though? I see what John's saying, is there, you know, there's good, you know, apples and bad apples in every barrel, but that's surely not helpful, is it, for the people who have this very, very critically important work to be doing?
I think John's been rather tactful, actually. I mean, I think this is one of the situations in which the media absolutely do their worst. I mean, they can do something that is actively harmful, but also they make idiots of themselves because the gap between the demand for the speed of news, particularly, of course, from 24-hour channels, most of all, and the speed at which something like this is likely to go is just so big that it just makes idiots of everybody. I was looking at TweetDeck about half an hour before I came into the studio, and a presenter or reporter from Al Arabiya was reporting a very brief press conference in which Brahimi, the UN negotiator, was basically saying absolutely nothing at all. And she was reporting it, you know, in six tweets as if it was kind of hot news. Now, you know, if one is attempting to put oneself in the shoes of one of these sensitive, intelligent journalists, how nice it is that John has met them, one would say, you know, they would have to say, look, it's going to be months before anything occurs here. All this kind of concentration, I mean, you can't not cover it. That would be wrong, obviously. But The idea that something is going to happen in a matter of hours or days, or even that what people are going to say during that time has much meaning, it's really not there. It's really not happening. I think it's a massive overconcentration of stuff gone, honestly.
I agree with all of that. Also, we have to remember that we can't assume that it is all going to happen in one hit. It is entirely possible that these talks will break up and reconvene at a later date, so people can go back, consult the capitals and so on.
One of the interesting points, I guess, is that the parties who appear to be very much at odds during this process were sort of given the opportunity at the commencement of proceedings to sort of have their say, and rather than striking any kind of conciliatory tones, which we're used to seeing perhaps in the Northern Ireland peace process, people would make the right noises. There was no measured remarks. People were very outspoken and said there was a great deal of finger pointing. Some suggested that the other parties had blood on their hands. That's surely beyond counterproductive. I mean, doesn't that render the whole exercise, you know, pointless, because the people have made their bed and they're going to sleep in it?
No, it doesn't. It would have been nice if they had been less rude to each other, but there we are. You know, they said what they said. There are lots of peace talks that have started off with screaming matches. A lot of the Balkan peace talks were actually much noisier than this one's been so far. And I remember that the talks that eventually led to the reunification of Yemen were also very, very bad-tempered at the outset. In some ways, it's almost better for people to get these things off their chest, you know, get their statements on the record. And, you know, when they feel they've emptied themselves, that they can maybe sit down and talk more sensibly. Let's say that happens.
There are so many dialogues, surely, aren't there, in which the participants have all got to have their basic say to start with. And if you are an experienced negotiator, you've just got to sit there and let it wash over you. And in the case of this, this could go on for days or weeks, this kind of position taking, before, you know, you may, only may, get to a place where the negotiator says, OK, guys, thank you very much indeed. Now, you know, is there any overlap between you at all? And you can maybe start to talk in more practical terms, or maybe not. We'll see.
Yeah. Remember, too, that a lot of these people have got constituencies back home who are listening to them, and a lot of the speeches we've heard, a lot of the vitriol, was actually aimed not at the opposition, but at their audiences back at base. They need to demonstrate that they're being tough.
It seems to me, maybe striking perhaps cautiously optimistic is the wrong word, but a more constructive view of this whole process. Do you have, if not high hopes, some hopes that we could see something more positive?
Yes, I have some hopes. I mean, it's far too early to tell, as George has rightly said. I mean, this could go on for weeks, months, who knows? I mean, remember that the Paris peace talks that didn't in the end the Vietnam War went on, was it 7 years? I don't know. It might go on for a very long time. Is it going to deliver at the end? It might do. I don't think anybody is in a position to say anything more than that at this stage.
Let's move on and turn to Tunisia and to Yemen, which you just mentioned, John, previously, both of which are dealing with the sort of birthing pains of fledgling democracy. In Yemen, the country's president has pledged at a ceremony in Sana'a on Saturday to form commissions to draft a new constitution. And in Tunisia, the National Assembly has just signed its new constitution into law over the weekend. This document, passed on Sunday narrowly, is as groundbreaking as one of the most progressive constitutions in the Arab world. Let's hear from Monocle contributor Navina Kotor. She was inside the assembly when the vote was announced.
That was the moment the packed assembly realised that Tunisia had just made history. Once again, with an overwhelming majority, after 2 years of drafting, the Tunisian Constituent Assembly passed one of the most, if not the most, progressive constitution in the Arab world. The chamber started spontaneously singing the national anthem. Emotions had been running high, not only among the assembly members who had been working non-stop towards this vote for the last 2 weeks, but also among members of the public who had come to witness the reading.
It means a new chapter. It means the consolidation of a people's goals and aspirations, of the suffering that many have endured, and of dreams for fulfilling a better future. And so I hope that we've really done that with the constitution.
The wider Tunisian public is less convinced, though. They're battling with high unemployment and inflation. But, says Damir Manai from the governing CPR party, there are still reasons to be proud.
We managed to advance with every step because we know other countries, they go back and forth, one step forward, two steps backwards. For us, even though it has been difficult, and maybe it has been going slower than expected, but we never went back on anything and we're advancing.
Critics say some articles reflect contradictions and not consensus. For example, Article 6 guarantees religious freedom, but says the state should strive to protect the sacred. It's a question I put to Mehersi Alabidi from the governing Islamist party Ennahda.
It depends which glasses we are wearing to read it. Tunisian society is diverse. Tunisian society is at the same time deeply rooted in its Arab Muslim roots, but it is very open on universal culture, human rights, democracy. I can see in it the reflection of the diversity of Tunisia.
A lot now depends on whether politicians will respect the new constitution in the future. But after months of political stalemate, for now, Tunisian lawmakers here are hoping to send a message of unity and consensus. For Monocle in Tunis, I'm Navina Kotor.
A sort of upbeat message from Navina Kotor in Tunis there. Is it always difficult to read the success or otherwise of these things? John, is it too early simply to say whether there can be whether there's been a success in this case?
There has been a success. I think that's very clear. But it's not the final success. I mean, this is a good start along a road that's likely to be rather bendy and very rocky. We have to remember that this is the constitution's been passed. But as Juma himself, the prime minister, said that the aim is to get to elections, and I think it's 2 years' time, so that the display of unity that we've seen over passing this constitution is likely to become unravelled quite quickly as campaigning gets underway and as all the passions of an election get going. That's the first point. The second point is that although I think there's a reasonable chance that the Tunisians left to themselves would create a decent state which balances the various pressures within their society, Islamists are likely to look at what has happened in Tunis and wince. This is not the model that they want to see for the Arab world. And I have a sinking feeling that before very much longer, we're going to see intervention in Tunisian affairs by people who are disturbed at what they will see as the victory of secularism within the Arab world.
That's an interesting point, George. I mean, more generally looking across the region, as Tunisia is an example of how that management of democracy and Islamism has happened. Do you think that's right? Do you share that concern that people will look to what's happening there and see it as a case for intervention from perhaps, more radical Islamists, for example?
Well, I think the intervention probably would be by radical Islamists. I do. And of course, like John, I hope that doesn't turn out to be the case, because left to its own, Tunisia has a relatively harmonious society in discussing these things. I mean, by which I don't mean it's perfectly peaceful. This constitution arose out of a political crisis after two secularist politicians have been killed, really. But it doesn't have natural resources, Tunisia. It's not geopolitically important. So its opportunities to kind of form its own society and work out its own rules are relatively rather good. I'm afraid John's absolutely right that Islamists will not consider this. This is, after all, a constitution which guarantees equal rights to men and women. Now, I've no idea whether that's going to work in practice, but even just to say it in a constitutional document in the Middle East now is quite something. And I think it's likely to provoke some reaction elsewhere. And as John rightly warns, until we know what that is, we don't really know whether it's worked.
It's interesting, John, isn't it, looking at the sort of post-revolutionary periods. You think back to, the French Revolution, a decade later, the fruits of it were not still really to be enjoyed. There was no obvious immediate democracy. Do you think when we look around the world, we're too quick to judge? And actually, that process is very drawn out. Several of the places we've visited in this programme so far, it is about being more patient, more pragmatic, more realistic about exactly how long it takes to build that kind of momentum.
That's right. We live in a world that demands instant answers and instant satisfaction. Diplomacy and political processes in general often take a long time to work through. Weeks, months, years, decades sometimes. Decades, certainly. in the case of the French Revolution. And yes, it doesn't make for headlines to say that nothing very much happened on this front on this day, but the overall tendency is generally positive. I remember, you know, I wasn't there, but the famous meeting where Mao Zedong asked in the 1970s what he thought of the revolution, said it's still too early to say. I think it's a remark we might want to bear in mind.
Absolutely. George, I want to ask you very briefly, you mentioned Yemen earlier. I should remind our listeners to tune into our special foreign desk, which is available for them to listen to now, monocle.com, on Yemen. Slightly this kind of poor cousin of the Arab uprisings in some ways. All the journalists sort of went to Tripoli and to Cairo. A few went to Sana'a. Do you think that there is a problem in terms of the willingness of certainly the Western media to sort of treat all these things equally, to actually say, well, look, the situation in Yemen deserves the same kind of attention. It's another barometer of the sort of the Arab Spring period. But perhaps because it's not as notorious a destination, perhaps, that it keeps the big correspondents away. Is that a problem in the media, do you think? Or do you think there are people who are, you know, considering these other outposts?
I think there are people who are watching it. I mean, it has to be said that there are fewer journalists in Yemen, I mean, partly because it shares with Tunisia not having any natural resources. It's not geopolitically very important, and so it is down some people's lists. The other aspect of it was that, well, for a period, kidnap was a real risk in Yemen, and I think that probably cut down the number of people who went there to report. But one thing we have to remember with all these things, although there's an enormous amount of caution and lots of reporters misread some of these situations, Syria, Egypt, and so on, because they were projecting onto them their own thoughts and wishes about how their own societies work, perhaps as an example of one mistake. But in none of these cases where the existing constitution or state or political consensus has broken up, are they likely to go back to what they had before? Mm-hmm. But secular autocracy, generalizing a little bit hard, which dominated a number of these societies, is finding it extremely difficult to reestablish itself. You can say that it's just about operating in Egypt at the moment, but on a somewhat fragile basis. And it's not, you know, it's having a tremendous, I mean, nobody can win in Syria, if you see what I mean. The rebels can't win and the government can't win and so on. So nothing is going to go backward. Nothing is exactly going to go in reverse, even if what looks like a hopeful opening doesn't always turn into it.
That's George Brock. John Everard is here as well. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. John and George will still be here when we return. We'll be talking about Ukraine next. Stay tuned.
What is it to be typically German? Well, Rolf Sachs, a half-German, half-French artisan designer, explores the clichés that form his notion of a nation in a new exhibition at Köln's Museum of Applied Arts. Culture editor Robert Bound went to sort the Schadenfreude from the Sehnsucht.
There are certain very clear clichés, which obviously are part of the show. Punctuality, industriousness, hard-working. But I wanted to show the full depth of really German character. We always say that we are the nation of poets and thinkers, and there is always this being torn between the mind and the rationality.
Typisch Deutsch, a Robert Bound film now showing on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are John Everard, former British ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, and George Brock, professor at City University London. Let's turn now, as promised, to the Ukraine. The country's justice minister has warned anti-government protesters occupying the ministry building that a state of emergency could be called if they don't exit. It's the latest development in an escalating crisis in the country. George and John, it's intriguing, isn't it, looking at Kiev, the problems we're seeing on the streets. Do you fear this escalation, a sense of emergency?
Excuse me, Tom, I think you're just a little bit behind here.
Yeah.
They've moved out of the Justice Ministry, those exactly. protesters. Oh, well, they're sitting outside it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is good.
But they appear to have been pushed away by that emergency rule threat. I mean, we don't exactly know. All that I know is they're not in the building. They're kind of around the front of it. Yeah. So there's a constantly shifting line here. Mm. You know, the authorities say you go any further and we're really going to bring the ceiling down on you. And they back off a bit and so on and so on. And then they start up demonstrations in different cities. It's a moving, it's a fluid and moving situation. I mean, my fear about it is that I don't think I think Yanukovych is just simply, along with Moscow, simply playing for time. I mean, he appeared to make concessions over the weekend and naturally, as people always do, I mean, got very excited about this. I find this terribly hard to believe in. I cannot see why he, from his own point of view, should really mean it. So I suspect he is just stringing things along. But maybe John has a different view.
No, I think he is playing for time. I think that the other sort of interesting point is that the protesters have said they will negotiate now with the government. And they've had a few hours of calm in Maidan Square in Kiev in memorial for the 25-year-old who was killed there. I think a lot depends on Russia. And we'll know a lot more about where Russia stands after tomorrow's summit in Brussels. Of course, Putin simply doesn't believe in popular democracy. He believes that these protesters have been orchestrated by Western intelligence agencies. That's just the way he sees life. And I think there's a certain amount of nervousness as to how far Putin still adheres to the Brezhnev doctrine. A lot of Russians, and I think this would include Putin, simply don't see Ukraine as an independent country. Ukraine is just part of Russia that, through a geopolitical accident, was severed from the motherland. Does Putin believe that he has the right to intervene directly in Ukraine if things don't go his way? I don't think anybody quite knows the answer to that yet. The other point we have to remember is that Putin has no time for Yanukovych. He regards him as an idiot and as a feat. Yanukovych has been under terrific pressure from the Kremlin to crush these demonstrations using the brute force that we've sadly seen elsewhere in the former Soviet Empire. Of course, he can't. He's tried to use the police. They've been pushed back time and time again by the protesters. But I don't think Putin understands that. And Yanukovych must know that, firstly, these protesters aren't going to go away anytime soon. And secondly, that support from his principal backer in Moscow cannot be taken for granted.
If I was a representative of the Russian intelligence services in Ukraine, I would be running around desperately trying to find a replacement candidate to run the country who would actually be more intelligent and effective while at the same time being sympathetic to Moscow. That, I mean, as often happens in client states, they've ended up with a dud in charge and they begin to realize just how big a dud he is. He can't control things. He's now stuck in a kind of standoff with these protesters. The protesters can't get very much further. The government can't get rid of them or do away with them and shouldn't, obviously. And if Moscow really likes the kind of idea of sort of predatory manipulation, they can be independent in name, just providing there's certain things they don't do or certain lines they don't cross. And as John said, Yanukovych is just incapable of kind of understanding how this is supposed to work in practice in new circumstances.
So where does the momentum then for that change come from, John? And, you know, if you look at Ukraine, if it is being pulled in these two conflicting directions with sort of EU on one hand and Moscow on the other, what are the drivers for that kind of change? And frankly, are there any people who could fulfill that kind of role that George describes there in place of Yanukovych?
Whether there are leaders in the wings, I really don't know. I'm sure that George is right that a lot of people will be looking for one. Whether you could actually groom one up and get him into power in any meaningful way and the time available, I doubt. What is driving this change? I mean, I think the protesters speak for themselves. They want better lives. They want a government that is not corrupt. They want a government that actually governs. I mean, a lot of this is simply about good statehood. They are deeply attracted by the EU. They like to think of themselves as Europeans, and they resent Russian dominance. I was fascinated by the way that the protests have now spread into eastern Ukraine over the last 24 hours and places where you simply don't protest have started to protest, and government buildings in Yanukovych's heartlands have started to fall to protesters. I really don't quite understand why this is happening, who is leading this protest, but it is certainly a very significant development and could well mark the beginning of the end for the current setup in Ukraine.
Mm. And let's also not forget that that in the east is where most of the industry is. If that industry isn't working, the Ukrainian economy is going to collapse. Really, absolutely everybody, Ukrainians first and foremost, loses. Even Moscow loses. So it'll cost them a fortune to do something about it if that's the position they find themselves in.
Absolutely. That spread east of those protests will be something that we'll watch very carefully. Just finally, let's end by considering the, well, the Washington Post, I think we can call him a blogger extraordinaire, Ezra Klein. He left his post last week after his paper denied his request to fund a new policy-focused venture. But now Klein, the head of the Post's incredibly popular Wonk blog, has announced that his new site will become part of the Vox Media Group. George, I just wonder what your view on this is. Do you think it was a smart move for the Post to let go of Ezra Klein?
Well, on the face of it, no. But we don't know what these negotiations were like. The Post has, albeit it's got a very rich new owner, does not have not necessarily have vast amounts of money to play with, and he was in a position to probably ask for really quite a lot. There's got to be some point at which an institution strapped for cash is going to have to say, well, you get, we're calling your bluff, off you go. It could have happened that way. It might have been a lot of money. He might have asked for more than, and he's gone to Vox, who have an awful lot of venture capital money flowing through their veins. They want new assets, a way that the Washington Post wouldn't quite need necessarily new assets. But what it's very typical of this is how these new online and purely online businesses are really becoming quite big commercial players in their own rights now. This is new formations in news publishing. It doesn't mean to say that all the established names and all the established institutions we know are going to fade and fall down, but it does mean that there are absolutely new players and they're going to be with us for quite a long time. And what some of these new players that started very small, after all, Ezra Klein is now a major player. He can move, he can really move the counters on the board. He started as a blogger, just typing away his words, with nothing else behind him at all. So small things can become very big. That's how, and even today's media giants, they were little once.
Everyone has to start somewhere, John. Very, very briefly, do you think that the sort of the establishment are tuned into that process of change? Are they very alive to the kind of exposure that people like, Ezra Klein can have? Are they mindful of that, do you think, in their pronouncements?
I think they will be now. I think a lot of people were watching what's happened and sort of drawing some very difficult conclusions. And I think Ezra Klein may well go down in history as the man who changed the way that organisations relate to rising young stars like him.
Fascinating stuff. Those are the insights of both John Everard and George Brock. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed, both of you, for coming on to Midori House today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House programme. We'll be checking in with our man in Buenos Aires, looking back at the winners and losers at the Grammy Awards, and we'll review the latest in the London art world. All that's still ahead. Before we get started, though, let's hear from Paul Osborne. He's here with the latest world news headlines.
The head of Egypt's army is set to confirm within days that he will run for president. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi led the move to depose Mohamed Morsi last year. Today, Egypt's top military body approved his candidature and promoted him to the rank of field marshal. Talks on the crisis in Syria are deadlocked in Geneva. Representatives of Bashar al-Assad's regime presented a declaration of principles that made no mention of a transfer of power, which is a key demand of the opposition. It's thought up to 74 people have been killed in attacks on two villages in northwestern Nigeria. 52 are believed to have died when militants attacked a village in Borno State. Further south in Adamawa State, 22 people died in an attack on a church service. Both have been blamed on the Islamist group Boko Haram. In Ukraine, anti-government protesters have ended their occupation of the Justice Ministry in Kiev, which they stormed on Sunday night. They withdrew after the minister threatened to call for a state of emergency and an end to negotiations with opposition groups. And China says its Jade Rabbit moon rovers got into trouble. State media say it's apparently unable to easily traverse the lunar surface. The rover landed on the moon last month for a three-month mission to explore its surface. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. Paul Osborne will be back with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's 21:34 in Moscow, 18:34 here in London. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're heading to Buenos Aires. Our correspondent, Ed Stocker, is armed and ready with the week's top stories. Ed, thanks for joining us. Good to speak with you, as always. It's economic worries, I guess, that's dominating the agenda where you are.
It is indeed. It's never simple in Argentina when it comes to economics, I tell you. And essentially what's happened recently is that, last week the peso dropped in value for the biggest fall since its economic crisis 11 years ago, 2001-2002. Since then, the government's been trying to kind of overhaul, really, I guess, its economic policy. A complete change in tack that's raised a few eyebrows and obviously eroded a bit of confidence in terms of overseas investors. What's happened is they're now saying that having introduced pretty extreme restrictions on people buying foreign currency back in 2011, they're now saying that people can buy US dollars for saving purposes. There's a whole load of restrictions. You have to earn over a certain amount per month, which is 7,200 pesos, and you can only buy a certain amount, $2,000 a month. But a change in tack, and people don't really know what this means if, in fact, it's going to be that easy now to buy dollars. Obviously, people... a lot of people who can afford to want to buy dollars because of the high level of inflation, thought to be around 25-30%. So therefore people want to have dollars as a saving currency because they trust it more. But at the same time, the government also wants to hold onto dollars because its foreign currency reserves are ever shrinking at a 7-year low. So quite a complex situation to try and sum up, but kind of uncertain times, certainly. And Argentinians who do want to save, kind of unsure about where this is going to head.
Well, I just wondered, Ed. I mean, it does sound like, with rising inflation, those kind of fears. Are we going to see, run on the bank? Is it this kind of thing? Is this a situation that's going to rapidly get a lot graver, do you think? Or is there some confidence that some of these remedial measures will actually help to arrest this alarming decline?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say run on the banks because, the government, the head of the cabinet, Jorge Capitanich, has been accusing Grupo Clarín, which is the main media group in this country and very anti-government, of sort of trying to provoke, as you say, a run on the banks. It's highly unlikely something's going to happen like that, that, we're going to be in another 2001-2002 type situation. But at the same time, it's quite remarkable how the peso seems to be sliding in value. It's decreased in value a lot, just in the last few months, this year, in 2014. At the same time, obviously, people who are anti-government, you might say, accuse the economy minister of not really having a clear path. For what is going to, what they want to do with the economy, how they're going to solve this inflation problem. At the same time, it does seem to hit the consumer, the Argentinian who wants to save, still problematic in that sense, still new clampdowns on people buying via the internet overseas. If people want to buy dollars to travel, if they want to use a card overseas, they have to pay a 35% surcharge. So at the end of the day, it's really hitting Argentinians. You have to, I guess, jump through all these loops in their day-to-day life, something actually, to be honest with you, historically, they're kind of grudgingly used to.
Absolutely, Ed. Let me ask you about what President Cristina Kirchner Fernandez then is doing. Is she at the home front, manning all the stations, making sure this crisis is dealt with? Or I gather, in fact, instead she may be swanning off for a bit of a LATAM Caribbean head sort of powwow with all her friends.
Indeed. She's already in Havana, actually. She is attending the summit of Latin American and Caribbean heads of state that have taken place later in the week. But actually, she's gone there early. She's gone there several days ahead of the summit. So, again, that's raised a few eyebrows. Some people suggesting that there's, you know, a domestic crisis, that obviously there is a serious economic problem that needs to be addressed. And so wondering why she decided to go early. What's suddenly true is that on Sunday, yesterday, she was having... She actually reportedly had lunch with Fidel Castro, although she's by no means the most left-wing firebrand in the region. She still is part of this kind of pink tie, this leftist set of leaders from the region, and so Fidel Castro and Raul Castro are very much among her allies. So I guess in a way going there to kind of shore up that alliance and also meeting with the Brazilian President Rousseff at the same time. So again, shoring up some of her allies. Interesting too, her first trip since her head injury, since you know, she was operated on in October of last year, signs that despite speculation that there has been recently that she's to a certain extent you know, back to her old routine, back traveling, back at international events, and back tweeting quite ferociously. So we'll have to see as well if that actually lasts going forward.
Absolutely. Ed Stocker, Monocle's man in Buenos Aires, thanks very much for joining us on the programme. Up next, we're going to be looking back at the winners and losers from the Grammy Awards. Stay tuned for more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
The February issue of Monocle will help you plot your global progress in 2014. Turn the pages to find the villages, cities and nations you need to visit for inspiration, work and play. Whether you're looking for a new HQ, want to get that movie made, or perhaps are a spy, we'll tell you how to plan your itinerary.
Where do you go to go it alone? The forest in Oregon. Where's the best place to set up a design shop? That'll be Taiping Shang in Hong Kong. And a furniture studio? Danzigerstrasse in Berlin. In the design section, we've crossed the globe to discover the places we'll have designs on in 2014.
In the edit section, we charter a new course for 2014 from behind the kitchen counters of Flanders, Belgium's up-and-coming culinary destination. We interview the rising chefs and food growers that are changing the region's image and putting it on the gastronomic map. We also take a sip of Georgian wine and Mexican coffee, some of the indispensable products in Monocle's pantry for this year.
The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, last night was the 56th Grammy Awards. Everyone from Daft Punk to the Beatles showed up. Well, some of the Beatles. Joining me now to cover the highs and lows, perhaps, is Alice Vincent, who covers entertainment news for the Telegraph newspaper here in London. Alice, welcome to the programme.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you here. Tell me, I always worry when I see, you know, sort of old rockers wheeled out in their bath chairs at these sorts of events. Is that a bit dull? Is it a damning indictment? They get a few of these aging rock stars on, or are you a bit of a traditionalist? You like to see them taken to the stage?
It does make me cringe a little bit, if I'm honest. It seems to happen every time with the Grammys, and sometimes it's great. I mean, look at Nile Rodgers last night; he was amazing. I didn't think the Paul and Ringo thing really worked, if I'm honest. But then the Grammys is like the grand old dame of music awards. It's just what happens.
And so is it a problem, do you think, of innovate? Is there a fear about innovating? Or do you think it's more that there's a bit of uncertainty about what the audience actually really wants to see and hear?
I think it's a difference between the voting partners of the Grammys and what the audience want to see and hear. We're obviously very different in the UK to everyone who's voting over in America. But at the same time, if you tried to innovate the Grammys, it just wouldn't work. They're stuck in their ways. They are what they are. If you want something else, go to the MTV Awards, I think.
Absolutely. In my opinion, you don't want to be going there. I think we can hear a little bit of the Beatles, can we? Let's have a little listen and see what we make of this one. And nobody who could help saw that in the end it turned out that I had to do it by myself. Life's a game, life's a ritual, life's a bitches, what to pay. Difficult to know which way to turn. So any better at second or third listening? No, I see you're making quite a pained expression.
Yeah, a little bit. It's a shame. I do love the Beatles, just not now.
Resolutely no. Well, yeah, they're probably a little bit too old for that. let's talk a little bit about Daft Punk, who've probably sort of captured a lot of the headlines. How important do you think that is that they triumphed in the sort of best album category? Should we read anything into that? What do you think that tells us about where we're at the moment in the music marketplace?
I mean, I think it's a sign of what people who listen to music are aware of for a long time, that dance music's finally coming to the fore properly. It's a great album. It's the best yet, according to its critics, for Daft Punk. And I think it trumped everything else in that category. Deservedly so.
Well, let's hear a little from Daft Punk and let the listeners make their minds up. So that's a little from Daft Punk. What about the sort of performances on the night then? Did anyone really kind of dazzle you? Who most impressed you in terms of who delivered at the event last night?
Well, we just heard a clip of Daft Punk performing last night, and that was definitely the best performance. I mean, Nile Rodgers was amazing, Stevie Wonder was amazing. They got them all together and smushed all their hits together. It was great, and it was understated for all that. They got up and they did what they did best.
And do you think there's any sort of people we should be looking out for then on the back of this? I mean, it's already successful acts, but can anyone go sort of into the stratosphere, do you think, even off the back of what we've seen?
I mean, I think if you hadn't heard of Lorde yet, then this is going to be a great push for her. Chances are, if you're under 20, then you will have, because she's had a phenomenal year. But again, she performed and picked up an award last night and did brilliantly.
Now, there were some very kind of high profile. We mentioned the Beatles, Daft Punk. Tell us a little bit about this Same Love performance, because that's another thing that's kind of really dominated, I guess, all around the world in terms of the media and just music fans. Remind us about this one.
Yeah, well, that shows what the Grammys do well, which is big TV, like live broadcasting of pop appearances. And so when this single came out, it was very important because it was one of the first songs supporting gay marriage, which did really well in the charts. Macklemore and Ryan Lewis have continued to get praise for it, and they managed to get Queen Latifah to marry 33 same-sex and straight couples on air last night. Coolest wedding ever.
I think it will be. Let's take a look. I think we can hear a bit of this performance from last night. Let's take a listen.
When I was in the third grade, I thought that I was gay, cause I could draw. My uncle was, and I kept my room straight. I told my mom, tears rushing down my face. She's like, Ben, you've loved girls since before pre-K. Tripping. Yeah, I guess she had a point, didn't she? Bunch of stereotypes all in my head. I remember doing the math, like, yeah, I'm good at Little League. A preconceived idea of what it all meant for those that like this.
So that's a bit from this Same Love performance. I mean, you mentioned that's what it really does well. Do you think that when we see these kind of events, do they do enough to sort of push different agendas like that to really make statements? Or is there a bit of often complacency or a bit of kind of laziness when it comes to really trying to sort of push the envelope a little?
I do think that last night's performance, Same Love, was unusual because we don't often see a lot of that. Often it's a bit of a who's who can we get together, who's got an agenda of their own to push rather than the wider implications of it. The interesting thing last night about Lorde winning is that she won and performed a song which went against capitalist culture and celebrities and stuff. And I don't think really everybody got that. I don't think that was intentional necessarily.
It may have fallen on some deaf ears. Yeah. Just briefly, I mean, anybody sort of overlooked who you feel maybe should have, was a more deserving recipient, or anyone just generally who you think we perhaps should have been recognising during a sort of award season?
I mean, I think the Grammys are never going to pick up on little people necessarily. I think Daft Punk, it genuinely, 2013 was their year. They deserve to win. I wouldn't really pick anyone aside from that.
The year of Daft Punk. Thank you very much, Alice. That's Alice Vincent with her roundup of the year's Grammys. And given it's the year, or it was the year of Daft Punk, perhaps we should, in our musical segment next, listen to a little more Daft Punk. Let's hear this one. It's Lose Yourself to Dance.
Lose yourself to dance.
That was the sound of Grammy triumphant Daft Punk with Lose Yourself to Dance here on Midori House. Yes, you're listening to Monocle 24, 7 minutes before the top of the hour. We're ticking towards the end of the programme, but before that, as promised, it's time for our daily review segment. We go through the best in books, theatre, art, music, cinema, with our correspondents, contributors and friends all around the world. Today we're talking art. I'm delighted to be joined here in the studio by Fisun Gunera, visual arts editor of theartsdesk.com. Fisun, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you with us in the studio. Where should we start then? So much to choose from, I guess, in London, as always. Martin Creed, perhaps.
We're kind of spoilt for choice. It's going to be a very busy art month. Martin Creed is opening with a major display at the Hayward Gallery. And I think most people will know his work. It's The Light Switching On and Off, one of the works for which he won the Turner Prize in 2001. And they're probably thinking, how on earth is this artist? If they're not that familiar with his work and they just know that work, they're probably thinking, how on earth are they going to fill the vast galleries of the Hayward Gallery? It's actually quite a busy exhibition. He's a fun, whimsical artist. I mean, there's a real vein of humour running throughout the display. So he may surprise a lot of people because he's more than just light switching on and off. When you first go into the gallery, and it's just filled with stuff and it's also beautifully curated, you know, you're confronted by this huge, mega huge neon sign which reads Mothers, and it's rotating on an axis, and you actually think it's so low, you actually think it's going to decapitate you. And it's actually frightening. It's actually, you know, you go underneath it and it kind of just, you feel it's just skimming your head. And it kind of puts you on edge, and all around that spinning neon sign are metronomes ticking away, and they, you know, they remind you of a very famous sculpture, a very famous artwork by the surrealist artist Man Ray. And all throughout the exhibition, there are kind of amusing riffs on other artists, you know, other modernist artists. So there's a lot there to amuse, but you know, it's packed into all that. There's a lot of riffs on art history as well.
So there's a lot of, he has his signature kind of style and wit, but also there's the substance there as well, you think, at this show?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think so. A lot of people who just know the light switching on and off might be surprised, and might be surprised how engaging it is, actually.
Well, that's what we like engaging to see, isn't it? A bit of surprise, yes. Surprise depth, yeah. Where perhaps we weren't expecting.
Yeah, and it's nice to see someone filling that space with, you know, so many humorous works. If you like David Shrigley, who also had an exhibition at the Hayward last year.
That was an excellent retrospective,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
You'll probably like Martin Creed.
Great stuff. Well, that's a pretty good endorsement. Let's move on and talk about Sensing Spaces. Tell us a bit about this one.
This is very different in tone. The Royal Academy has invited 7 architectural practices from across the globe to create installations in their main galleries. And it differs. I mean, architectural exhibitions are quite hard to pull off because what you're usually confronted with are lots of diagrams, lots of photographs of the work, film footage, and also models. And that's pretty hard going. I mean, you have to be, you know, quite interested in architecture and quite knowledgeable about architecture to really get anything out of those exhibitions. And what is usually missing is the interaction with the building itself. Now, Sensing Spaces, its subtitle is called Reimagining Architecture. And we're not only asked to reimagine architecture in our experience of it. You know, it's really, the Royal Academy is really reimagining how to put on architectural exhibitions. And this is quite an ambitious display because basically you're being invited to really experience the building, the architectural space, and you can climb up buildings, and you can even you can use your sense of touch. You know, architects are even deploying, you know, your sense of smell, so that, you know, you're really not just reading screeds of text. It's a really interactive, and it's very ambitious, and it's quite a brave exhibition to put off, but I think they've really pulled it off, actually.
Wonderful stuff. Well, it sounds like an immersive, tactile experience for all the senses.
It really is.
Wonderful stuff. Well, that is Sensing Space, Architecture Reimagined at Burlington House. And before that, we were talking about Martin Creed at the Hayward. Fisungene, thank you very much for coming to speak with us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, so we'll have to leave it there.
Not David Hockney.
We're out of time, unfortunately, but that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Pacheco and Anade Satuma, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
It tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.